Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American Old Chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 7th day of May, Anno Domini 2022, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues, here comes the news.
Ta-da!
Google is offering a new tool to anyone who doesn't want their phone number, email, or street address and other personal information to be found online. People can ask for their contact details to be stripped from search results. The new policy sharply lowers Google's bar for removing data from search results. While it previously offered to scrub personal and financial information in cases of a real or potential threat, such as doxing or identity theft or stalking, the company says people can now ask for their information to be removed even if there's no clear risk. Anyone wanting to submit a removal request can use a special online form that walks users through the process. It asks for things like the URL of any web pages displaying your personal data along with search terms and URL of Google search you use to find those pages. It also recommends including screenshots. So it's not going to be as easy as putting in your name and saying, erase me. It's important to remember that removing content from Google search will not remove it from the internet, which is why you may wish to contact any hosting sites directly if you're comfortable doing so. So it will remove you from Google's database, but if you're on, for example, somebody else's homepage, it will not automatically remove you from there. It's not magic. It's just technology. Even with the changes, there are still a few reasons Google might deny a removal request. They mainly deal with information that is deemed broadly useful or part of the public record, such as newsworthy data or material that's posted to government sites or other official outlets. Along with contact information, you can ask Google to remove results that include login credentials and other sensitive data. Google is expanding its policy around protecting personal information because users requested the change. The new search policy comes 6 months after Google made another change to allow minors or their caregivers to request their images be removed from its search results. That shift came as Google and other tech companies faced criticism over their policies toward children and minors. One of the largest early adjustments for Google search tools came from Europe, where a Spanish man's case established the right to be forgotten in 2014. In the 4 years that followed, Google said people made more than 650,000 requests to remove specific websites from its search results. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis, would like us to remind you, is you can ask Google to remove your personal info. And the choices are, about time, that's nice, meh, wait, Google has my info, and other. So far, we've got 20 votes, and that's nice is just barely ahead of about time. And if you said other or you have more to say about this subject, and I know you do, you can head on over to our website at soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, you'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least the number one item under poll discussion is 7 May 22. You can ask Google to remove your personal info. And in there, I also give a link to the Google support page that tells you how and what and where and how and why to remove your personal information. And, of course, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. This all came out of that Spanish man's request, or lawsuit, to be forgotten on the internet. He had that right, and the European Union gave it to him. So now anytime you create any website that may or may not have a presence in the European Union, that would be any website because it's the World Wide Web.
That's what a lot of folks tend to forget.
Yeah. you must include the right to be forgotten. So I had a website for a while for makers of 3D printed objects. And one of the things that I had to do was you signed up, right? Mm-hmm. And there was an exchange thing going on. So people had their email addresses. Some people had their home addresses, mm-hmm. all of that stuff.
A lot of personal information.
And I had it all encoded, encrypted.
Wasn't going to be easily hacked.
But because many of the people who were on that website were in the European Union, they had to be allowed to be forgotten.
Yep.
And so obviously that meant everybody had that right. So I had to write code that would go through and remove any and every trace of that person. And it worked quite well. It was a little tricky, considering that, you know, it's a database and it's a relational database and there are relations among those people, and the objects that they did and all that other stuff. But the fact is that I managed it, and it is a little trickier than just delete this single entry, but it's doable. And if I could do it, Lord knows professional programmers should be able to do it without any trouble.
Sometimes it's just plain.
I don't think you're on.
Yeah, sometimes it's just plain lazy programmers.
Well, that's a lot of it. You know, yeah. It's complex programming, yes.
Yeah.
But if you're a professional programmer, you should be able to handle that. The problem, you're right, is laziness.
And sloppy coders. I mean, right. That's one thing back in the day, you know, when I was at Kodak, we had to throw in comments after comments. Yes. You know, any different small procedure, they didn't care how small it was, it still had to have comments. So you knew if somebody else, you know, like my boss used to always say, if you ever got hit by a runaway garbage truck, we want to be able to still come in here and know what the heck you were talking about when you wrote even just a small procedure.
That's part of disaster recovery. You have to be able to recover everything. And
a lot of it comes down to not having enough budget. You can have it good or you can have it fast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And most people are picking fast.
Right.
Yeah.
You can have it good, fast, or cheap. It's the programmer's pie.
Yeah.
Good, fast, cheap. Pick any two.
Yep.
You can have it good and fast, but it won't be cheap. You can have it good and cheap, but it won't be fast. You can have it cheap and fast, but it won't be good. So you got to be aware of those realities. And yeah, it was an interesting exercise for me to write the code, to write the database, to plan the database before I ever wrote anything in such a way that I could, with, you know, a single command, get rid of not only that person, but everything about them and everything that they had put into the database.
That's probably a daunting task.
In any table.
Backwrite a database that was written 30 years ago in COBOL.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I had the luxury of designing it from scratch.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that could prove to be an interesting conundrum in that, all right, so you go ahead and you write your code, and if by chance, again, if it's a sloppy coder, and they go ahead and write, you know, and get something up, and it's got all this personal information, and somebody requests to have their information removed, which, like you said, they have the right to do. But if it gets hacked by somebody else and winds up going elsewhere, they're not gone. They're still there.
Right.
And are you now liable because code wasn't strong enough to get them off the internet as per their request?
Right. I had all kinds, and I'm not going to tell you what they are, but I had all kinds of checks and balances and coding tricks and things that I did to make sure that people's data were secure. And, you know, knock on wood, for the entire time that site was up, there were no break-ins. But there was a lot of very personal information in those tables.
And that's the thing. Folks don't realize, you know, or take the time to really let it sink in that it's called the World Wide Web.
Right.
And when you put something up, even though it's just, it's just over on this website, it's open to the whole world, folks. And, you know, it's just like some folks are shocked when, you know, they do or post stuff, and then all of a sudden they go for a job interview or something else, and all this other stuff comes flying out that they did or responded to or whatever, because, oh, I thought I got rid of that. No, it's out there on the web.
Right.
And it can go back to bite you.
It's going to live there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Google has also struggled with, this whole right to be forgotten thing. You can be removed, and you can do it now even easier. You can be easily removed from Google's database, but Google's results include other people's databases. So that's a problem, and that's not an easily solved issue.
And wasn't one of the original cases, you know, somebody had like committed a crime 20 years ago, and you Google their name and it still comes up? It was 20 years ago. You can't fault me for that now, which you can sort of understand a little bit, but
right.
Yep.
So how long ago are things you've done still valid?
Well, that's why we say, you know, people got to take some time and think when they're, you know, putting stuff out there, which they don't. Yeah.
Right. Right. So, all right, we should probably go to the phones. Our first caller is Mike from Batavia, who I hope was patiently waiting on the line. What's up, Mike?
No, I find that interesting. It was funny what Dave said about, you know, for every line of code, they wanted a line of comment. And then you look down at the bottom and you look at who made the change, and it's the head of the IT department.
Right.
So who could fire you in a minute? you have to really pay attention to that code and what you, you know, any changes that you make to it.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Usually I wait for the second hour. I let people with problems, but I get a hitch with this one. I'm having my 50th year reunion. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And some of the people, you know, are disabled, you know what I mean, and they're living in Florida, and it's impossible for them to make it to the reunion, okay? And how would you, like, we can have a big screen, and it'd be some type of way to Skype to them, and then, you know, all they would have to need is their phone, okay, a smartphone, and, but what, how would you do that? How would you guys, because, you know, you guys are wicked smart, so, you know, I figured you've got a better idea, you know, how to do this, you know what I mean? How would you go about it? What would be the, you know, your technique? If you had to make that contact, how would you do it?
Like a go-to-meeting type of thing.
Well, yeah, and so there's a trade-off between cost and duration. So you could do Skype. Skype is mostly designed for one-to-one, but I think you can do 10 for free. Or something like Zoom, which is in essence unlimited, but you only get 40 minutes for free. But if you just restart it at the end of the 40 minutes, then that same link works again.
There's also I'm in a peculiar situation here. I work for a company called Mastermind Lounge, and that's a thing that we do is people's data. If you want to make contact with me through, you know, Ask Nick or whatever, I can talk to you about that, and we can see what if this is a free deal for you guys. We can see what we can do about that. I can't promise anything, but I'll certainly look at it. But the thing is, these guys are right. There are 100 video chat sites out on the web. Most of them are either limited in time or cost money. So finding the right mix of inexpensive or free and unlimited time is very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my first question is, okay, you've got the big screen. What would you connect to it? Are you going to take a Chromebook, or are you going to use a phone, or what would be?
You'd probably have a laptop.
Yeah, laptop or a Chromebook. Depends on the site you're going to, but a Chromebook would do it. Would do it.
Yeah, some sites you host it yourself on your own computer, and some sites they host it at their end, and everyone connects to them.
Yeah, usually if you're setting up, say, at a hotel, and you take a laptop because you want internet connection through the laptop that you can hook up your internet, and then that goes to the big screen. And if you say we're using, like, GoToMeeting, You would pull up, you'd start a session for Golden Meeting. You'd send the invite to those various folks. They would call in, and little windows, little panes would open up, and they'd have to have, you know, Golden Meeting set up on their computer with a camera, and they could talk, and everybody can talk to everybody else.
And that's another thing to think of, too, is that some of the solutions, like GoToMeeting, need to have a program running at the other end. So everyone you want to join your you know, reunion would have to install this program.
Whereas with things like Mastermind Lounge and Zoom and things like that, you just it's a website.
Yeah, it runs in your web browser and doesn't need any.
And so you can use your phone or your tablet or your Chromebook or your desktop or whatever you want.
That's one of the reasons that Zoom sort of made it so big during the pandemic, even though you know things like Skype and Microsoft Teams were there for years. But Zoom is very easy to use and requires very little setup on the novice user's end. And so it made it pretty easy for people to get in.
So you need at your end, one of the things you now have to become is a videographer. Where do you set up your camera to show everything? Or you have somebody repositioning the laptop regularly or whatever it is you want to do.
Another overhead camera to show all the cameras I have in here.
Yeah, right. Or you
I can do that on my phone.
You can hire Steve. He can. He's got two cameras, three cameras running right now.
Yeah.
And he has certainly the possibility of more. He could.
I need more ports, so I have to get a hub.
He'd have to get a hub.
Well, I can do it all remotely.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hey. StreamYard is free.
StreamYard.
Yes. StreamYard is free. Unlimited duration, 10 hours a month.
Right.
So if you don't think your meeting is going to be more than 10 hours,
then it's
free for that month.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay.
And so StreamYard works through a browser. One person hosts it, and it can be streamed into your YouTube page, onto your Facebook page. And you can have guests come into the StreamYard from anywhere in the world, anywhere on the internet, with their browser. And it is completely free for basic use and offers 10 hours a month for free.
Oh, okay, super. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah. Good show. Thank you. Bye, Jeff.
Thanks.
Bye.
Yeah, there. Like we said, there are many, many possibilities out there for this stuff, and it depends on whether it's a thing you want to do for free or a thing you want to get paid for or a thing that's going to take less than 40 minutes or a thing that's going to take less than 10 hours. And there's a lot of variables that you have to deal with if you're going to do that sort of thing. Like I said, the one that I'm involved with, Mastermind Lounge, is designed for people who want to do one-on-one or group lessons or chats and get paid for it.
Yeah, StreamYard got really popular among podcasters, which is where I found it, because it easily allows remote attendance, remote guests. So you can have guests all over the world come in and then send it out to your Facebook page very easily.
Yep. All right.
I'm sorry, 20 hours a month. They've increased the free plan.
20 hours!
A month. Yeah.
That's good.
So that's almost an entire day of reunion.
Yeah.
There you go.
Too much time.
That's way too much time for most of the people I knew. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from all the way in Justin, Texas. Justin?
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi there, how are you?
All right.
How are things in the great state of Texas?
Well, right now it's blue skies and warm weather.
There you go.
Isn't that a Texas law that every time you say Texas, you have to say the great state of Texas?
The great state of Texas, exactly right.
Well, I'm liking it now.
Okay.
I have a general question because I've heard you guys talk about password managers, and I think I'm finally going to get one. So I want to use it on a Chromebook and my iPhone, two different platforms. If I set it up on the Chromebook, will all those passwords work on the iPhone? Just a general type question is what I want to know.
Yep.
You can even do that with the Chrome's built-in password manager if you put Chrome on the iPad. But for third-party password managers, KeePass, 1Password. What's the one you like?
N-Pass.
Yeah, I heard you talking about N-Pass.
Yeah, they are all cross-platform.
The way this works is as follows. Let's take N-Pass as an example, although they all pretty much do the same thing. There are apps for iOS, so that fits your iPhone.
Yep.
And apps for Android, so that fits your Chromebook, because Chromebooks do Android apps. So what you do is you put that on each platform. Then when you sign in and set it up, you tell it you want to store the database, which is encrypted, by the way. You want to store that database somewhere on the web, whether that's on Google Drive or iCloud or wherever. And then for each of those devices that you have it on, it will reach out to the web to open up the database.
Okay, to wherever I choose to store it. Okay.
Right. So, for example, the other day I added a password on my phone. It was immediately available on my desktop, my laptop, my Chromebook, my tablet, because it was all saved out on the web.
Okay, and you need to just, make up the one master password, we'll call it.
And
don't lose that, and then I'm good.
Right, that's exactly right. You do not lose that master password.
Right. Yes, the big thing about passwords is they prevent people from getting into your stuff, including you.
That's right.
All right. Well, then, thank you. I think that's just what I wanted to know, that they would work on both platforms.
Yeah,
that's how I have a Chromebook and an iPad. I mean, my iPhone.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have fun, Mark.
I know.
Then you need to get a Windows computer to have the trifecta.
That's right.
Oh, here we go. Are there any that have a Windows Phone client?
And who would download it?
The one person still using
Drake.
Windows Phone.
Yeah. Still somewhere in a drawer has a Windows Phone. Sorry, Lee. But yeah, look, we've talked about this before, and it bears repeating because many of you do not, clearly as Mark states, do not have a password manager. And the real question becomes, why not? You should have one. You absolutely should have one.
Every time you say, I can't remember that many passwords, the answer is you don't need to get a password manager.
Right. And then you only have to remember one password. And that one should be complex and long and et cetera, et cetera. But it's easy to remember one, particularly if you don't do, 473 left elbow J, but instead you do horse staple battery, right? So... You can string words together. That makes a long and complex password. Put in a capital, put in a number.
I've been trying to make a concerted effort not to say password anymore, passphrase.
Passphrase, exactly.
But then I had a customer the other day got confused. What's the difference between a password, a passphrase, and a passcode? Nothing.
Nothing, really.
Just the words.
Your password shouldn't be a word. Because there's dictionary attacks that try every word in the dictionary, and they'll get into your stuff.
Right, mm-hmm. But if you combine multiple words with upper and lower case and some symbols and some numbers, you've got what's called a complex. Complex doesn't necessarily mean difficult to remember or hard to understand.
No,
it just means complex as far as a computer is concerned.
And it's not normal text that you would see, say, in a dictionary.
Because computers can do simple things really, really, really fast. And so something called brute forcing, they will try A, and then B, and then C, and then D. And then they'll go back around and try AA, AB, AC. They can do a million of them a second. So it doesn't matter if to them.
But if your password is 17, 18, 25 characters...
Yep.
And that makes it hard. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. We are Sound Bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Don't go too far.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
Thanks. And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And on the YouTube channel, Arch Andrew reminded us of Jitsi, which we also used to use. That's another one that gives you the same sort of stuff that
video chatting
yep. That the others do.
That's more of a roll your own, though.
Yeah, yeah. But it works, and it works nicely. So that's good. Before we get back to the phones, let's. This is an important news item, I think. Microsoft has warned Windows 11 users that they might experience launching and using some .NET framework, experience issues launching and using some .NET Framework 3.5 applications, of which there are very, very many out there. The .NET is the background programming environment that many, many Windows programmers use. This known issue impacts only systems running Windows 11 version 21H2, where users have installed the KB5012643 optional preview cumulative update. Affected apps use optional components such as Windows Workflow and Windows Communication Foundation. Microsoft also addressed another known issue triggered after installing this Windows non-security update, leading to flickering screen problems and safe mode without networking. The same KB5012643 issue also made some Windows apps, for example, File Explorer, Start Menu, and Taskbar.
They're not very important.
Not very important. Seem unstable while running in safe mode.
Don't need those.
Don't need those.
No stinking program.
Right. Microsoft asked impacted users to uninstall the problem KB5012643 update to work around this issue and restore their .NET Framework 3.5 apps functionality. You have to open the Windows Update Settings window by searching for Windows Update in the Start menu. From there, you need to click View Update History, hit Uninstall Update, then click Uninstall after selecting the KB5012643 update from the list. And, of course, that's easy. Those who cannot immediately uninstall this cumulative update can mitigate the known issue by re-enabling .NET Framework 3.5 and Windows Communication Foundation from the Windows Features dialog. IT admins and advanced users can also use this via an elevated command prompt. Microsoft is currently working on a resolution to address this issue and will provide an update in an upcoming release. Did you lose access to some apps after the update? And how do you feel about being a guinea pig? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
And they will continue to use you as a guinea pig. As long as you use Windows.
You know, I'll tell you what, it's very weird to me. I have no trepidation updating Linux. I have no trepidation updating Android. I have no trepidation updating Chromebook.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I have to update a Windows system, I hesitate. I break out in sweats.
Well,
is it going to come back up again? Is it going to work?
I had another experience where... I don't know why I did it, because normally I don't. What I'm referring to is whenever I create documents, normally I'm using Google Drive. But I had to write this one article, so I used Word.
And I will come over there and slap you, just as a public service.
Thank you, and I deserve it. So, while this person insists that it be done it. I'm not going to go in those politics.
Right.
But anyways, I did it, and I had it on my desktop. And because I had to do this article, and I thought, all right, I'm going to go ahead and get a head start on it.
Right.
And I wrote it 2 months ago.
Yep.
And I tucked it over the corner and forgot all about it.
Sure.
Well, it's due. And I went to go grab it. And evidently... Like Steve and I were talking about before, you know when it's supposed to write things that are on your desktop off and then put it back when it does these updates?
Yeah.
Yeah, it wrote it off.
Oh, good.
But didn't write it back.
I'm not surprised.
So I go to grab the article, and it says, sorry, this doesn't exist. It's like, you gotta be...
I can see right there under recent, it does exist, and here's the path it's in.
Oh, no, I can see an image of it, and I can even see all the little snapshots and everything else that I pasted into it and did all this cropping and everything else. Poof. Gone.
Yep. That'll
Thank you, Microsoft.
That'll learn you. Listen, write it in Google Docs and then download it as a Word document. You can do that, and it works perfectly.
I was just trying to... This is the one and only article I have to do.
Yep.
No more after this, because, like I say, I do everything in Google Docs. I have now for the past 5 years. Google Docs, spreadsheets, everything. It's done up there in the cloud. It doesn't matter what computer I go to. I can sign in, grab it, and use it.
Yep.
And it's always there. No issues. And it's on multiple devices, whatever I log into.
Yep.
So, and the only thing difference between, you know, because I knew Word pretty good, was, like you say, the different keystrokes and all that for doing this or doing that. And
once you get used to the ones in Google Docs, you don't want to go back.
Yeah. And that's the problem. Yeah, I didn't.
Yep.
But
well, you've learned your lesson, I hope. And let me get a ruler out.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I was so ticked when I went to, because it was ticking me off. Worse when you can sit there and see the image of it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there's no bringing it back.
Well, if you'd have saved it on OneDrive like Microsoft wants, it'd be no problem.
That's right.
They actually make it hard to switch to your own local computer when when you start.
They can take OneDrive and put it where the sun don't shine.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right, then, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Irondequoit, New York. Hiya, Jim. What's up?
Well, a couple weeks ago, I wanted to transfer a very large file to a thumb drive. And I discovered you couldn't do it. And you had to reformat it to this NTFS format. And I was just, is there any drawbacks to using that format? And should I reformat the rest of my thumb drives in that capacity? And the other thing is, when it says, you want a quick format, I say, well, if I didn't do it quick, maybe it would be better. And I unclicked that, and of course it took forever. It
takes forever.
And I was wondering why. What occasion would you not do a quick format?
All right. So let's unpack this a little bit. One of the reasons that you don't that you couldn't save your document, your file on your thumb drive is because it was probably formatted for FAT16.
Or maybe FAT32.
And the maximum file size there is 2 gigs. So if it's larger than 2 gigs, it will not save that file. NTFS does not have that limitation. It is the new technology file system, NTFS, new being, 1987 or
something like that.
Something along that line.
No.
But that is NT, the new technology, Windows NT. 93. I was off by 5 years, as I am these days. Yeah. Everything is farther away or closer than I think it is. Yes, I am. So NTFS is just the new format. It is. It allows much bigger files. It is It has been the standard format since, 1993?
93.
Yeah. So it is perfectly safe. It is usable by dang near everybody. I think Windows, Macs will read it.
Readable but not writable without third-party software.
Right. So if you've got a Macintosh that you want to share data with, you can give it to them, but they can't save it back to that drive.
There's a newer format called XFAT that is becoming compatible with everything, including Linux and Mac and Windows.
Right. But in terms of Linux, NTFS is perfectly writable and readable on Linux. As to whether it's better or worse, 6 of 1 depends on what sort of files you want to save. Until you hit that 2 gig limit, it mocks nicks, right? Yeah. It makes no difference.
The other sort of sneaky limit I found accidentally on FAT is 127 files at the root.
Right.
So you can't put too many files on the flash drive. You got to put them into folders.
You're right. If you put it in a folder, the number of files is unlimited.
Yeah.
But at the root, you only are allowed 127. So that's a second thing. In terms of fast or quick format or regular format, quick format assumes it's a good drive. It assumes it was working before, and you just basically want to zero out the directory. It doesn't delete files. It doesn't do anything but remove the directory entries.
Yeah, it resets the header.
Right. So if you do a full format, that actually wipes out the drive and reformats it and does everything for real as if it were brand new.
So it makes it less likely someone could recover the data from that disk. Right?
Yep.
So if you had sensitive data you want to get rid of, you want to do a full format. If there was a problem with the drive, you want to do a full format because the act of formatting will block out bad sectors.
We had a customer want us to wipe the data on the drive the other day, so we did a DOE 3-pass certified wipe. It took 3 days.
I was about to say, you're still doing it.
Yeah. I tried a 7-pass once.
No.
And gave up after a week.
Yes.
And then there was a 35-pass.
Yeah, there is.
That the slider bar would go to, and I didn't even want to think about it.
No.
Go on vacation and come back, and that's a 2-week vacation.
Yeah, that's right.
And it still won't be done.
Sorry, what?
My question, why do they have it if it takes so long? I mean, I thought, this is ridiculous.
Because some agencies in that require it.
Yeah.
To be thorough.
Yeah. If you work for certain government agencies, a 35-pass wipe is a minimum.
Yeah, and if you put a file on a disk and gave that disk to someone, they could go through and recover all of your stuff that you used to have on that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Without having that full format.
You think you erase something, and it's gone. You think you're good. Well, I'm here to tell you that most crime labs, and this is no joke, can get down to each bit that has been erased probably 6 times past, and still pull the information off that drive.
Right, which is why the 35 pass exists. Now that you're not going to mostly care about that.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, unless you're saving financial data on that thumb drive, you're not going to really care. But it exists for those people who do.
Yeah. You start talking to government and top secrets and personal information and everything else where that's critical. Then, it's essential that you have that.
Right.
Okay. Thanks very much for your answer. That was perfect.
Yep. Thanks, Jim. Have fun.
Yeah, I've started seeing new flash drives coming in XFAT format.
Nice.
Where they were used to be FAT32 all the time.
Right. When you format a thumb drive, think about where you're going to use it. If it's only for your use and it's only local, then and you don't have any 2 gig files, then it doesn't matter. But if you're going to be sharing it with certain people, or you're going to be storing a file that's larger than 2 gig, then it does matter. So be aware and be careful when you start those things. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Scott from Buffalo, New York. Hiya, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I have a Mac, and the latest update, which was about a week or so ago, after that, I noticed that no longer when I save files, it automatically go to, I don't have a printer, so I asked it to save it as a PDF. It doesn't do that anymore. I'm not sure what's going on.
The PDF menu is missing from the print command?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it's on mine. I'm running 12.3.1 that just came out. Sometimes there's a hide details or show details button to give you more information under print.
Yeah, there was nothing else. In fact, I don't have a printer, so nothing showed up almost. It didn't say anything. It was just like an empty space or something.
Right, so if you don't have a printer, you can't print.
But the print dialog should still come up and give the option to save and add a printer.
Save and add a printer. I forgot about that, right. But it didn't let me save to PDF like it used to.
What program are you trying to save with?
This is Microsoft Word.
Did they start using their custom? Some programs use a custom print dialog that doesn't have all the features that the actual print dialog does.
Right.
Yeah. I just went into my Word, and the PDF option is there.
I was about to say, instead of printing to PDF, you should be able to save as PDF.
That might
what
work,
I wanted
too.
To do. Right. I want to save as PDF.
Yes.
Yeah. Save
as, yeah. Yeah, that shows up.
From the file menu, file, save as, PDF. That should work in Word.
But I'm in Word 1660, and I can still print, and I have a save as PDF function menu. Little menu in the bottom left corner that lets me.
But at the very least, can you also go file, save as?
Yep, file, save as.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's in a subcategory under export.
Oh, sure. Okay. Export to PDF. Yeah. I get that. Yeah.
So there's common formats, and then there's export formats, and then there's specialty formats.
Ooh.
Specialty?
Yeah.
XML files.
That's people who juggle flaming batons.
Oh.
Those are the specialties.
Well, flaming chainsaws.
Flaming chainsaws.
Oh, there you go.
At any rate, try file, export, PDF.
All those things.
You may want to check if there's an update to Word, too, maybe, because that save as, or the print as PDF should be there.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yep. All right. Have fun. Yeah, the vagaries of the exact same program mm-hmm. on different platforms
don't exist.
It just makes me crazy.
Apparently, there was a problem in Windows 10 and 11 where the print to PDF feature disappeared from Word.
Oh, there you go.
And that is in the Windows features set. Turn a Windows feature on or off. But Scott said he was using a Mac.
Yeah, he did.
Right. So,
Why would? Okay.
Yeah.
Why would it's Windows.
Why would you even need a feature to turn off printing to PDF for it to be a checkbox?
I don't even work there. So I'm not even going to care.
That's above our pay grade.
That's exactly right. Almost every word processor allows you to save as or export as PDF. As we were talking about with Google Docs,
it's always been there. As a matter of fact, Word came out later.
That's right. So I believe it's under download as. I believe it's under download as PDF or download as.
Yeah.
Word document or whatever. There's half a dozen different formats.
And the nice thing about, for case folks don't understand, is if you save it as a PDF, you can send it to somebody, and then they can't go changing anything.
Without expensive software.
Very expensive software.
So in other words,
if you lock it and password protect it, they can only read it.
Yeah, and you can sit there and say you're doing up a quote. They can't, alter numbers, this or that or whatever. It's locked and they can't do anything to it.
They can't mess around with the format. They can't change the fonts. They can't. And in fact, you can embed fonts in a PDF so that even if they don't have the font set you used, they can see.
Yep. They can see it and read the document
the way you actually intended it.
PDF also came out in 93.
There you go. So 93 was a good year for computers.
Yeah.
Evidently.
So, yeah, you should be aware. Take a look through your whichever word processor you're using, and you may discover that there are a lot of interesting features that you've never played with.
It used to be a paid add-on because PDF is actually developed by Adobe, and it was proprietary and commercial for a very long time. But most of the until they made it a public format. And in essence, published the source code for it.
Right.
So then now we have compatible PDF readers.
Yeah, Foxit.
Right.
Foxit and others. Yeah. And so all the word processors.
Matter of fact, Foxit came out with a whole other brand that now you can create your own PDFs and you can do forms and everything else within Foxit.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's the other thing about PDFs. You can do forms. You can do all kinds of weird things in there. But you have to have the right software.
It's fun to play with.
It can run code.
Right.
So
that's dangerous.
Yeah. Many of the exploit vulnerabilities we read about say a carefully formatted PDF can do this, or a carefully crafted PDF can do this, can give you arbitrary root access to your computer.
Right. that's one of the reasons to be wary when you get a PDF, particularly if you got it from someone you don't know. I've had a spate of emails from people telling me, "Oh, here's your bill."
Yep.
And of course, when you get a bill like that, the first thing you want to do is look at it to see what they did wrong. But they're PDFs. I don't open PDFs from strange people. I know that if in fact I have in some way bought something that I don't remember, I don't have drunken buying at 2 a.m. So, you know, I've never done that. So I don't really, I remember what I buy. Now, unless I bought it from AliExpress.
Yeah.
When it takes 6 months to get to you, and it's always a surprise when you get it. But generally speaking, if you get particularly a bill from an unknown source and you know you didn't buy that thing, don't open it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that PDF may contain malicious code.
Well, the nice thing also about PDFs, Tim Allen, who did The Last Man Standing, on their very last show, they wound up doing a contest for ham radio. And I developed a PDF form for it. So I did it up for the show and I uploaded it to them and put my signature in that at the bottom. And then some other individual was trying to take credit for it.
Nice.
And I go, "No, you didn't. If you look down the bottom corner, there's my call sign." Oh.
Yeah.
Can't change that.
Yep.
So, yeah, that was a fun time, you know, because setting up PDF files and forms make it so much easier for doing a lot of stuff. And I've gotten in the habit of creating those for different things that I can automate it.
Right.
So, you know, it puts in the date and the time and all this other stuff.
Right. There's a couple of form generators on the web, including one from Google, which will save to a Google Sheets. So all the data come into a spreadsheet, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
It is not as secure as what Dave is doing, but most people don't need that.
Yeah, no.
And it's so quick and so easy. I've done so many forms that way. You know, here's a quick, not a poll, but a you know, something more in depth than say the poll we do. So they're easy to make. They're easy to use. And like I said, you get a spreadsheet.
Yeah, and the other nice thing about the forms with the like the Foxit that I use is you can have drop down windows so they can select.
Right.
You know, you can give folks various options to pick just to make it cleaner and simple to fill out a form. And I'm sure folks have used government forms and all that.
Yep.
Where you get the PDF form. And you can fill it all out and then print it off. You just sign it and then you can mail it on in and boom, you're done.
Right. And so, the same with Google Forms.
Yep.
You can make short answers, long answers, true, false.
Makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, it's all good stuff. So if you're in the market for some form of form manipulation, look at those two choices. All right. That music tells us you have wasted an entire hour of your life with this nonsense, but do not go away because there is an entire another hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. That's right. It's Soundbites. We're going to have more Dave Enright, too much Steve Ray, not enough Nick Francesco, and all of you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You are listening to Soundbites. Listen, it's going to be a longer break, so you can take time to take a bio break or go grab a snack or whatever you want to do and do all of that. But don't forget to come back and don't forget to join us because we'll have missed you. It'll only be a few minutes, but we'll have missed you. So don't forget to come back and join us and we'll see you on the other side. Take that bio break. I know I will. And we'll be right back.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Grease Rochester, a public service of the Grease Central School District and official media partner of this year's CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival, Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 9 minutes after the hour, I got to make a bigger clock, we are Soundbites. Before we get to the phones, after our first hour discussion about password management, I should probably read this announcement, this news item. In a rare show of alliance, Apple, Google, and Microsoft have joined forces to expand support for passwordless logins across mobile, desktop, and browsers. Passwords are notoriously insecure, with weak and easily guessable credentials accounting for more than 80% of all data breaches. While password managers and multi-factor technologies offer incremental improvements, Apple, Google, and Microsoft are working together to create sign-in technology that is more convenient and more secure. The three announced on Thursday that they are expanding support for a password-free sign-in standard from the FIDO Alliance and the World Wide Web Consortium, which means you'll soon be able to use your smartphone to sign into an app or website on a nearby device, regardless of the operating system or browser you're using. Use the same action that you take multiple times a day to unlock your smartphone, such as verification of your fingerprint, face scan, or device PIN. Users will also be able to automatically access their FIDO sign-in credentials or passkeys across multiple devices, including new ones, without having to re-enroll every account. While the three companies have long supported the passwordless sign-on standard created by the FIDO Alliance, users are still forced to sign into each website or app with each device before they can use the passwordless feature. So if I sign in with my Android phone, I also have to again sign on with my Mac, and I have to again sign on with my Windows device. This will alleviate that issue. Once you sign in, it remembers you. Users are forced to sign in, blah, blah, blah. Over the next year, they will implement passwordless FIDO sign-in standards across Mac OS and Safari, Android and Chrome, and Windows and Edge. This means that, for example, users will be able to sign in on a Google Chrome browser that's running a Microsoft Windows using a passkey on an Apple device. This will make it much more difficult for hackers to compromise login details remotely, since signing in requires access to a physical device. While the password has so far survived many attempts to kill them for good, this could be one of the final nails in the password casket. So do you prefer passwords or a phone-based key? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
We've got two problems.
Uh-oh.
One, it's called FIDO.
Yeah.
And we remember FIDONet.
We remember FIDONet.
Yeah.
Can't do that. And two, you know, Steve Gibson already created Squirrel, the secure, quick, reliable login using QR codes.
Right.
And he's solved all these problems.
Yes. Yes, but he solved it. They didn't solve them, so they're not solved.
And it's public and open source.
Which is not good for
you. And they can't charge you money for it.
And he can't charge you money for it. That's the big thing. Many of us have been using two-factor authentication regularly. But as you know, and as we were saying, yes, two-factor authentication. But the fact is, if I do two-factor authentication on my Windows device, I have to redo it all over again on my Apple device and redo it all over again on Android. So this will alleviate that. This will mean you do it once and it's done. And I personally like this idea. The whole idea behind multi-factor authentication is it's not just something you know, your password. It's also something you have, a particular key or your face or your fingerprint or your phone. So that's a good thing.
And one of the big problems with using biometric information like your face or your fingerprint is when the other end loses your data, which you know they're going to, there's no way you can change your fingerprint to safeguard that fingerprint that's now loose.
Right.
That was one of the things Steve built into Squirrel, is that the other end has no secrets they need to keep.
Right.
So even if they lose their secret, it doesn't matter. It's no risk to you.
Right. Right. All right, to the phones. Our first call of this second hour is Mark from Greece, New York. Hiya, Mark. What's up?
Afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Peachy, how are you?
I just wanted to tell you, I heard a really cute phrase, and I thought I'd pass it along. What it says is there really is no cloud. It's just somebody else's computer.
Yes.
I have a T-shirt that says that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one, you know.
And it's pretty accurate, too.
Yeah.
Somebody else's computer with a lot of hard drives plugged in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Everybody wonders, what's the cloud?
Just another guy's computer. That's exactly right. Thanks, Mark. That's great.
Yeah. Have a good one, guys.
You too.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. That reminds me, we had a text message from somebody who what was the text?
Something they wanted to know about VPNs.
Okay.
So do you really need one? And
right.
How secure are they?
Right. So a VPN is a virtual private network. The basic idea behind a VPN is it shields you from the other end. So if you don't want someone to know you're going somewhere, you don't want the other end to know who you are, you go through a VPN, which hides your identity and your IP address. So they don't know who that is at the other end. There are a couple issues with VPNs. First is the person in the middle, the VPN itself, knows everything about you.
Where you came from and where you're going.
And mm-hmm. where you're going.
Just like
and
your ISP.
They have access to all kinds of your data, passwords, even if they're encrypted. They have that encrypted file, that encrypted code right there, that piece of code. They know everything. So the question becomes, who do you trust? Do you trust a VPN company? There are some VPNs who say, and of course, if they log everything, then the government can come in and say, here's a warrant, give me your logs.
Yep, hand them over. Yep.
Some do not log anything, they say. Again, do you trust them? I ran for a while my own VPN, and I might do it again, just because, now that I've thought of it. I ran my own VPN. I know I didn't log anything. I know I'm the only person who had access to that. And I know that since I'm the only guy using it, it doesn't matter if I did log everything. I knew where I was going and who I was.
Mm-hmm. The typical use of a VPN is the work from home.
The original craze. Use.
The
yeah.
original use, yeah. You're at home. You log into the VPN at work. And to their computers, it's as if you're sitting at your desk at work. So you can see the printers at work. You can see the file servers at work. You can see all of your work stuff. Even though you're at home,
right? Because it was secure, so
yeah, you're virtually connected through the open internet.
Company business and everything else stayed there,
right? Yeah. Because it's fully encrypted, and depending on how good your encryption algorithms are, it's very secure.
Yeah, but all the TV ads you see about you need a VPN to stay safe on the internet,
right?
And especially if folks try to use the free ones and then think they're safe,
right?
It's free because they're selling your information.
If something is free, you're the product. That's a simple fact of capitalism. If something is free, you're the product.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very wary of free VPNs. There are Brave automatically gives you a VPN.
Opera does too.
Opera does. If you're going to use
Apple
those browsers,
is starting it.
Right. If you're going to use any of those browsers, well, you're kind of stuck with those VPNs. But I wouldn't trust them.
Yeah.
Not even Apple's. I don't care.
Where's your data going?
That's right. If the government comes to Apple and says, we have a warrant, Apple will say, thank you, sir, may I have another. That's just the way that works.
Yeah.
And so if you're just trying to prevent the person at the next computer in the cafe, in the coffee shop, from reading your data, that's what a secured, an encrypted connection to the database is. That's what that little lock in the browser thing is for. That's what that does. So the VPN doesn't help there in any way, shape, or form. If someone is going, let me tell you right now, the big target on the internet are the VPN companies because they've got those logs. Oh. They know who you are and where you went and where you go and what you do. And those are gold. They want those logs. Those are the people that are being hacked. So if you want to keep yourself secure, don't use a VPN.
That's literally a gold mine of information on people's surfing habits.
Right.
You think Google's bad or Facebook because, you know, you go off and look at something and all of a sudden on Facebook, you're inundated by page after page of the product that you just looked at.
Right.
And you were just curious. So I just want to quick check this out. Well, now you're going to be inundated for quite a while with that.
And there have been lots of news items of VPNs who sold the data, who sold those logs.
Your smart appliance doesn't need to listen to you. They know more than that already.
That's all right. That's exactly right.
Amen
that's exactly
to that right. One.
So, yes, as Steve said, if it's a VPN to your company, that's the point of a VPN. It makes it as if you were sitting at. So my daughter's job is distance. She works from home for a company that's not even in New York State. She's on a VPN all day long, but not for privacy, but so that it looks like to the printers and the servers and everything else as if she's sitting at a desk in that office, so they will give her access.
Yep.
That's the point behind that stuff. So if you're using a VPN for that, that exactly is the reason.
And it's the other point on that too is it's like she's sitting there, but it's also with the security that nobody can get into her stuff, hack it, or steal information, or that even though she's working on it and typing over the airwaves, it's secure.
Right.
It's like a pipeline that you're not going to tap into.
Right. And all the data are saved on the computers at work. So
nothing saved on hers.
Right. She has nothing saved on her computer. She doesn't use any local, she doesn't use Word or any of those local things. She uses the word processor through work. She uses the databases and the spreadsheets through work. And so nothing gets saved on her computer, which keeps it secure. And it's a government job. She's got government clearance. So it had better be secure.
Well,
that's how that works.
I always tell folks, equate it to like the old days when you were at work, and it's just now at home, and you turned on a terminal.
Right.
And all it was that monochrome screen that you knew you had to do a login, and it connected you to the server wherever it was within the company. You didn't have to worry about, printers or anything else. They were already automatically there. So it wasn't going anywhere else except to that server.
That's exactly right.
There has also been a history of VPNs used for stealing movies and music. And I read about law enforcement agencies that will ask ISPs about excessive VPN usage.
Right.
So your daughter might want to make sure she keeps track of what she does.
Right.
So if you're on the VPN for 8 hours a day, they're going to assume you're stealing a lot of movies.
Yeah. Yes. Although I am sure that at some point they went to her VPN, her ISP, and said, where is this person going?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, this law firm.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. That's a legitimate
different
job.
Story.
Rule one, don't annoy the lawyers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not on a watch list.
Right.
I'm sure they've got watch lists all over the place that, traffic going to these ports or this or that.
I've told this story before. I got a letter from Universal Studios, and I thought, finally, my big break. I'm out of here, suckers. Yeah. I'm going to be a star in Hollywood. Turned out to be from their lawyers, accusing me of having stolen a movie.
A movie.
A movie. That's all it takes. One movie. And they wanted to know what the story was. Well, as it turns out, every computer at that time, every computer in the College of Business at RIT was registered to me because it just made it easier. If we had to replace something or change something or whatever, whatever, I could just do that. So I was the owner of record of the computer that had broken into, who had stolen this movie. The movie was the Adam Sandler film, The Waterboy. Trust me, if I were going to steal a movie, it would not be The Waterboy. Trust me. So
good movie.
Is it? But not, I would never know. I will never know.
I've seen it. It's been on TV a number of times, but nothing worth stealing.
Nope. No, thank you. Anyway, the point is, so I wrote them and I told them all this, and I said, if you'll send me the information, the IP address and all this other stuff, I can tell who it was. Turned out to be a student who had borrowed a laptop from us for a project. So they came in and they were going to sue him, and they were going to sue him huge.
Mm.
And we talked.
Is it a treble damages so they could get $60 out of the $20 theft?
It's not a $20 theft. It was a multi-million dollar theft. So we talked to them, and they what they did was they put a sealed letter in his record. Part of his, you know, permanent record
that no one ever looks at again.
No one ever looks at again. Well, except that they would look at this.
Yeah.
This, you know, if you go to a place to get a job, and they see you're a thief, they're less likely to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
So they put this thing in, and they said, if you don't steal another movie in 4 years, the time you're in college, we give you permission to rip up this letter. And so that's what we did. And the kid, straight and narrow from then on, believe me when I tell you. And all he did was download this movie from a torrent site, as so many people do. What most people don't understand is that many torrents are actually put up by the companies. So Universal Studios actually put up the torrent of The Waterboy, which meant that they could go in then and look at the logs and see that this kid had used the torrent and used it. And if you think torrents are secure, you're living in a fool's paradise.
Even with a VPN. Every torrent program tells you better install a VPN.
Right. And it was on the Tor network and all this yada, yada, yada. And they still found him inside a half a minute. So, yeah.
Virtually every torrent application will then turn around and seed that file to other people. So now you're serving the file to the entire internet and
at your IP address, by the way.
So 4 billion people could download that file illegally. Then you get treble damages on that.
Right, right.
Yep.
So, yeah, you really want to be aware that there is no privacy. There is no secrecy on the internet. Just be aware. Just be careful of that. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's like what we were saying the first hour. You know, people don't, you know, lose track that it's, the World Wide Web.
Right. That's a problem that people don't seem to understand the scope.
It's like a postcard in the mail. Anyone along the way could read it.
That's right.
They probably won't. They don't care, but they could.
Well, but I encrypted it. Okay, that just means I don't read English. But I can find someone who does.
And in a few years, when computers are better, we can maybe decrypt that.
Right. Or we can decrypt it now. If I'm the government, trust me, you can't. There's no algorithm that really works for you.
I was looking at
one-time pads, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get. Okay, one-time pads. I wrote a bunch of Python code for one-time pads, which works actually shockingly well, but generally speaking, a one-time pad means you encrypt against a grid that is random and not reproduced anywhere. There's two copies of it, one for you and one for the other person. And once you have used that pad, you throw it away and you never use it again. So each and every document you send out that's encrypted is encrypted differently.
Yep.
So that makes it easier. Not foolproof. You can still, in many ways, depending on what other algorithms you use inside the one-time pad. Anyway, let's not get into that because that's a whole long.
Well, we were talking about cloud storage, and I found a article here from 2013. The total cloud storage is about 1 exabyte, 1,000 petabytes.
Now it's more like a yottabyte.
So in 2020, that's about 44 zettabytes.
Zettabytes, all right.
Which is more than 1,000 yottabytes in a zettabyte.
Right, it's exactly right. So, yeah, there's a lot of data out there.
The stories that the NSA has been saving every encrypted communication just in case computers get strong enough to break that encryption in the future.
And with quantum computing, they're saying that's really going to be the end of encryption.
Yeah.
As we know. Yeah. So that's a thing that you're going to want to be aware of. Again, you know, it's like with VPNs. Who do you trust? If you don't trust anybody, your life is miserable, but you're probably safer on the internet. Miserably safe. All right. We're going to take a quick break. If you're on the line, please stay on the line. We'll get to you right after the break, I promise. But we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, with the people on the line, and with you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites. This is member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Tom from Penfield, New York, on the line. What's up, Tom?
How you doing today?
Peachy, how are you?
So this is a follow-up call. I called about 4 weeks ago. I was trying out Zoom PWA, and I couldn't get the sound to come through my speakers.
Right.
Other people could hear me, but I got no sound. And right at the end of the call, just before the break, we're getting close to the break, you blurted out, go to your extensions and turn them off and see what happens. So I opened up my extensions. I only got about 8 extensions in here. But one of them caught my attention. It was a disable HTML5 autoplay.
Ah, yeah, there you go.
So I turned that off and went back, and guess what?
Yep. It works.
I had sound coming out of my Zoom PWA, so that was the problem.
Excellent.
And, the guru with one word out of his mouth fixed my problem.
We got one right, people. Mark down that
we're
day.
We're marking that. Now, what day was this?
This was about 4 weeks ago, I think I called
it. We're going to inscribe that on the wall here. We got one right.
Yeah. HTML5 autoplay. HTML5 is the newest standard for the internet, the web. It's the language of the web. And one of the features that it has is a thing called autoplay. Many people turn that off because, let's face it, it's annoying as heck to go to a website and stuff starts playing.
Automatically.
I don't need that.
Oh.
The problem is, one of those places that automatically starts playing stuff is Zoom. If you are using PWA, the Progressive Web Application, it is using HTML5 rather than, as Steve said, many programs require you to load a program. The PWA version does not. It is strictly web, but it does it through HTML5. So if you have turned off autoplay of HTML5, you're at the very least going to lose audio. You may lose video.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, good catch there on our part, I guess. So thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just wanted to call back in case someone else calls in because I guess in June they're getting get rid of the old Zoom application, and PWA is going to be it, as far as I know.
Right. So one of the reasons.
Kind of have the problem.
Right. One of the reasons that they're doing that is because too many people are moving away from Zoom because you have to download a thing and then blah 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 blah. Whereas if it's just a PWA program, like so many of the others, it's much easier to use. All you need is a browser.
And on the link that says open app, underneath that it says use in the web.
Right.
That you just click on anyway.
Right, which most people are clicking on anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I found that when I do open it up, I have to hit the 3 dots at the top to actually run it in Chrome, and that gives me a full screen.
Right.
If I don't do that, the video is not very good, and the pictures are not very good. So I have to run it in the web. And also, I only get 9 frames.
Yeah, right.
25 frames usually, and 9 is okay most of the time. But I do something like where I need a lot, like 25 frames, because I'm in a fairly large meeting.
Right.
So I don't know if PWA only does the 9, it's kind of a negative, you know?
That's a feature of the way they've programmed it. I'm sure that as time goes on, they will fix that.
Yeah, I hope so.
It's the other beautiful thing about PWA is all the programming's at the back end, so you don't have to update anything. You don't have to download it. They can fix it at the back end, and next time you log on, you get the new program.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got any more time for me? I got another thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah, go ahead.
So when I go on Zoom, like on one night of the week, I play music on Zoom.
Yeah.
And you have to use the original sound on Zoom to make things sound decent, because if you don't, there's a codec in there that tries to clean the sound up.
Yep.
But it's really bad for, like, stringed instruments. It makes them sound awful.
Yep.
And I found there's a new extension for Chrome that's called Original Sound that actually is supposed to remedy some of that. So if people are trying to use, like, Zoom on a Chromebook and they're having trouble with that, there is an extension now called Original Sound that's supposed to clean up or get rid of the codecs or whatever that it does to correct the sound.
I'm not
sure how well that works. I don't think it works as well as it does on, like, a Mac or a Windows machine, but at least there's something there. If you got a problem, I help you remedy it, you know, if you're playing music on a Zoom session, let's say.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, yeah, I got so excited about this. I sent in another donation, you know, but I unfortunately didn't have enough money to make
thank
up
you.
The gap that you guys are facing. So if you guys go away... Like, I beat my head against the wall for 2 days and couldn't get an answer for this on any place I looked on the web, and you gave me the answer. So if you guys go away, there's going to be a lot of people beating their head against the wall.
Thank you, Tom. Sorry. I'm sorry you didn't have a spare $13,000 lying around.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Tom.
But we appreciate what you could do. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Keeps us going.
Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you, guys. Thank you, guys, for being there. I hope you can stay there.
Thank you. Me too. Thanks. Bye-bye. Before we go to the next phone call, Janet from YouTube, back when we were talking about multi-factor authentication, said, what if you lose or break your phone, when we were talking about
or change your phone number, which is one people often forget.
That's why you have a recovery email address or a recovery phone number or a recovery something where you have yet a third way that you can authenticate who you are. And so that's a thing. And as our Chandra said, there's a thing called YubiKey, which is a hardware token thing that many companies, use. And for a while, Google was giving some away.
Yep.
I don't think they still are, but they were at one point. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Walter from Greece, New York. Hi, Walter. What's up?
Hello there, gentlemen. I run Linux, specifically MX, Linux 19, and I have a question about rootkits, and especially about RK Hunter. And it's really directed towards you, Nick, in that do you have RX...
RK Hunter?
RK Hunter telling you quite often that you have a rootkit problem?
Yeah. RK Hunter, for those of you who don't know, it's short for Rootkit Hunter. Rootkits are programs that take over your system. Before a rootkit runs before the operating system boots. So there is zero possibility that you can catch it and block it because it's running even before the OS loads.
Yeah, it gets loaded the very first thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are programs like RK Hunter, which will go out and look for rootkits. Mine runs, for example, every time I do an update, one of the things it does is it goes and runs RK Hunter against it. But RK Hunter has a couple of things that you need to do when you first install it, assuming you are fairly sure you don't have a rootkit. One is to set the database of what's in the system now.
Okay.
And the second thing is to run the update command to update the database.
Right.
And I update the database every morning at, I think, 3 or 4 a.m. I forget. It's just in my cron tab.
It's automatic.
It's automatic. And then every once in a while, I will run the RK Hunter.
Are rootkits that prevalent in Linux?
They're not that prevalent, but they do exist.
Okay. Not as much as a, say, a Windows machine or
Mac. Right, right. But you want to do it, so you want to run RK Hunter space dash dash update to download the new versions of the text files. And then if you know your machine is clean, it's dash dash prop upd, PROPUPD.
Right.
Property update, which will compare the file properties of commands against those that were stored and updated and et cetera, so that if you sometimes when you download, for example, a new version of a particular file, like anyone that is deep in the
it's
system, anytime you update that, RK Hunter may say, "No, whoa, this is different."
It may
be a rootkit.
It can be hard for any of the anti malware company programs to tell the difference between a good install and a malicious install.
Right.
Yeah.
So the short answer is never install anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Get the programs you use now and never get anything else.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the reason I called, because I'm constantly checking it, making sure I do the updates, et cetera, and it keeps, RK Hunter keeps telling me, okay, we've got an XORDDOS component hanging around, but it tends to be in var run udev.pid, which is just a number. Okay.
Right.
It's like, okay, that's nothing too much to worry about. And then it also tells me about I have suspicious files, but it's me running Firefox or me running the terminal. So
right.
It's like I scratch my head. The closest I've ever come to anything that gave me worried, and I believe you addressed it, was about doing an update. I did an update. I got Chrome. Okay, I figured, okay, nothing's going to be happening, so I run and then did the RK Hunter as well as CHK rootkit.
Right.
And they saw it, okay, here's this temp file. And it's like, okay. So I went to take a look at it, and yeah, sure it is. Got rid of that temp file, rebooted. Okay, everything's good, except RK Hunter still keeps telling me, okay, there's the XORDDOS components still hanging around. I think I'm pretty clean, but it is bothersome to see this thing constantly flagging something's amiss when I really don't see it. I've read somewhere saying, okay, if you got that flagged the one time, then don't reboot, because now it's going to know that it should have, the rootkit should have figured out you have some rootkit detection software, and now it's going to hide itself. Is that true, or?
Some can do that, yes. But in your particular case, I believe if you do a prop upd,
yeah.
What that says is, okay, RK Hunter, go through the whole system, look at all the files. These are all good. Change your opinion.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I do that, and it just seems to be hanging on. I don't believe the machine runs fine. I don't think there's anything crazy. I don't turn it off other than an occasional reboot because it looks a little slower. Seems to improve it. And then I've also gone to, what is it, top space dash CR, I can't remember what it is. I'm a little nervous here. And all I see is the PIDs, the numbers. Nothing looks suspicious. I don't see any other identification of a strange name or anything like that. So I think I'm running clean.
You probably are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, that's. I just wanted to know if you occasionally went into something like that.
One last question. Which version are you on, the latest, or are you one or two back on Linux?
He said 19.
I'm on MX19.2.
Okay. That may be an issue because the newer database, if you've done an update, the newer database is looking for the newer file, newer things. And if the program it's finding changed something, but you're still running the old version, that can be a false positive as well.
Okay. And that's the funny part about MX, though, in that I have one machine that is 19.1, but yet when you read that, they just say, okay, that's fine. Everything it gets updated, you do a full upgrade, but it never seems to change the identification of 19 up to 19.1 to 19.3, which is odd.
But that is odd.
Yeah, but that's the way they do it. And, well, as I say, I like MX-19 very well, and I'm looking forward to changing over to 21 perhaps next year once I've run out of this long-term support.
Thank right, you. Right, right.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yes.
One of the things he's talking about is that Linux versions come in two flavors. One is the regular flavor, where things get updated pretty regularly, but, of course, you get new versions of software that can break.
Yep.
And then there's the long-term support, or LTS version, where you may not get the newest and latest of something, but it's going to be rock solid, and it's going to run every day.
And it'll last for so many years.
And you usually get 5 years
yep.
Out of it. So 5 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
Anyway, the idea there is that I do that too. I'm still currently running an LTS version. 2204 is also an LTS version. And this is the one time of the year when I'm updating my production machine.
Ooh.
That I get the sweats. And so I haven't done it yet.
Oh, this, speaking of updates and that, what this guy, this one program that I think literally millions of people use in ham radio.
Yeah.
And he wrote it in using a Red Hat.
Yeah.
And he's a programmer. Well, he, you know, wound up putting this blurb because he was getting inundated with these messages because he said he just made a couple of lines, changes in the, just a couple minor changes in the code to his Red Hat server brought down millions of people that were trying to use this program because you would load it. And it just stopped. So go to the website. And he goes, yeah, I've been using Red Hat now for quite a few decades. And I'm a programmer. And I know better than to make changes without testing before putting it live.
Never change your production server.
And he did. He says, I got bit by my own rule. Yep. Never do it. And he was apologizing to everybody. And it's like, hey, we've been using this program. I've been using this program now for 3 years. And he puts it out there free.
Nice.
And I am a true believer, folks. It's any of the software that I use, if it's free and they're looking for support, I pay.
Yep.
Because that's the only way you're going to get updates. It's no different with AVG, Super Anti-Spyware, Malware Bytes, all those programs. To keep them up, yes, you can get them for free, but there's a lot more benefits of paying. Because then you're guaranteed you're going to get all these other updates and support. If you have a problem, that's one nice thing about this guy. I had a couple questions and setting some other stuff up to automate it for me. Bam, within a day, he's getting back to me. And this software, he's just doing it as a sideline. I mean,
right.
It's not like, and, but he's always there, but it's the people that, he, you know, support him. He supports them even more so.
I did the same thing. I had bought a piece of software. I had paid, you know, supported a free piece of software. I just sent him a thing.
Yeah.
And I had a question, and he answered it in an hour. And he said, that's a very good point. I'm going to make that change right now. Can I use you as a guinea pig? I said, absolutely.
Yeah.
So he sent me a file, and it ran perfectly, and I told him that. And next thing I knew, it was out there. So these people are, you know, it's, yes, it's free. Yes, it's blah, 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 blah. But he's they're very generally very responsive to people, and they get it all done quite quickly and quite nicely. So, I'm a big fan of paying for free software. Always have been. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. Hi, James, what's up?
Oh, yes. Hello. I got a quick question for you. I know you're coming to the end of the show. Have you ever heard of Alienware?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
We were a little worried when Bill bought
them. What is that exactly?
Alienware is a company that makes laptops, mostly.
Okay.
Very high-end gaming.
Very high-end gaming. I think they were bought by Dell.
Yeah, they were bought by Dell, and we were a little worried about that, but Dell seems to be handling them okay.
They used to make big towers, too.
Yeah, it was mostly gaming computers.
Yeah, all gaming.
Because it was a giant tower, so you could put giant video cards in it. Right. But more and more people want laptops, so they've been doing more gaming laptops as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a Dell laptop. I think it's in the gaming category, but I was doing some research on stuff. And I think I talked to you a couple weeks about the backlit keyboard.
Sure.
The light had gone off. And I read up where Dell, you read up on it, and they recommended. You actually gave me the answer, whatever you told me I did, and it worked great. But as I was reading, they mentioned this Alienware Command Center for maybe another way to do it. And I wanted to just check with you on that.
Yeah, if you are running an Alienware computer, then the Alienware Command Center will there's all kinds of switches in there, and one of them would be for the keyboard.
Every brand
light
computer generally has some sort of HP center, Toshiba center. That's sort of the center to control all of the functions in the computer.
But it is unlikely they would work if you were not running an Alienware computer.
It's specific to the hardware of that model computer versus the Windows control panel, which is for Windows settings.
Yeah, this is their version of like that, or to do with their Dell computers.
Right.
Yeah, it's brand specific.
Sometimes you find something like the keyboard in the BIOS as well.
Yeah. But I guess I wanted, because I had never heard of it, especially with the name Alien. I just wanted to make sure through you that there was no danger in looking at that.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's probably not going to work for you if you are not running an Alienware computer.
Yep.
Yes, but I'm saying there's no danger.
No, there's no danger in it. No, Alienware is a real company. It's actually owned by Dell.
Yeah.
And they're actually a very high-end, very reputable company.
Big-time gaming program.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a game, even though I don't do gaming, but this particular model I bought works for me. And, all right, I just wanted to check with you on that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, James.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of people like Alienware for regular work, too, because they're generally a higher end. Right. Better video cards, better displays.
And they were the ones. Yeah, and they were the first ones, I believe, to come out with all the lights and everything else within this big
cases.
Tower.
Yeah.
And you'd see all these green and red and blue lights and all
liquid,
that.
Liquid cooling. You can run the processor faster.
Ooh.
Yes. But I'll tell you that they are very high end and they are very proud of them, so you will pay a decent amount for them. But if that's you're what you're into, you're worth it. It's worth it. It's absolutely worth it.
Yeah, you're getting what you pay for on that one.
Yep.
For some people, the video card is more than the rest of the computer.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's where it all lies.
Right.
And, along with having a nice fast processor, the next thing is the video card and then memory.
Right. Particularly if you're a gamer.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that there are professional video gamers. Nationally ranked, they get sponsors, they get paid to play video games.
Yeah, and some of these chairs and everything else, you see some of that?
The chair you sit in, yep.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah. Look, if all you're doing is surfing the web and looking at your email and like that, then that $500 or $600 computer is probably more than you will need. But if you're a high-end gamer, then that $3,000 or $5,000 laptop may not even be enough for you that point.
No.
So yeah, there's a whole set of those things.
Like I say, it's all about the video, and the gamers in that they want fast response and everything else, and it's all lies in the video card. The reason I say memory comes after that is because the video card is chucked full of memory and processors.
Right.
Usually has at least a quad-core processor on it, minimum.
Right.
If not a couple of them.
And they're GPUs, which are specialized for doing math. So, that's one of the reasons that so many people are buying them to do Bitcoin mining. because they do math so fast, so fast. It used to be you bought a math processing unit for your Intel processor for your, you know, Pentium or whatever. But now it's all in the graphics card, and they're just super fast. Super fast.
And there's a fight now between the gamers and the Bitcoin miners to who gets the video cards first.
Right.
That's where the processing is.
Right. Prices have started coming down, so now they're only like three times as expensive as they used to be. And there was great rejoicing in the land at that. And I just thought, that's
yay.
It's not enough. It's not small enough. I'm sorry. It's just not. But it doesn't matter. The basic idea is that if you really want that kind of performance, you're certainly going to pay for it. But if you don't do that stuff, you don't need that level of hardware. All right. That music tells us we are done for another week. I want to thank every single person who called in or joined us in the YouTube chat. I want to thank Dave Enright. I'm going to thank Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. It is 58 minutes after the hour. You have been listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbite right here on the truly grateful to you and truly great and truly grateful to you that we try at least to continue to be member supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you next week. Be good to one another, will you? And we will see you in just 166 hours.